May it please the court, my name is Gary Apple, appearing on behalf of the appellants in this case. This appeal is fairly narrow. It's about attorney's fees and costs were awarded in connection with a hearing or following a hearing on a traverse of five writs of garnishment. The appellants whom I represent were not involved in the underlying case. The underlying case was an action to enforce a judgment against Jack Grindberg. I do not represent Mr. Grindberg. My clients intervened in the underlying case, in the traverse proceedings that followed the underlying case after their bank accounts were garnished. The banks responded to the writs of garnishment saying that they had no funds with the garnishees, and then the garnishment proceeding was followed by a traverse proceeding in which we intervened. In the traverse case, one of the interveners, one of the appellants, CCG LLC, was held liable for the judgment against Mr. Grindberg. The others were not. The other three parties were not. The plaintiff in the case asked for fees against the interveners in the amount of about $1.3 million, including substantial costs. So that was both costs and fees. And the trial court awarded about $824,000 in costs and fees, so reducing those fees significantly. This appeal raises three issues, three discrete issues, in connection with the fee award only. The first is whether the trial court used the correct standard in awarding fees. We contend it did not. The trial court applied a standard in this case in awarding the fees that allowed it to shift fees of the plaintiff incurred in traversing the bank's writs of garnishment and fees incurred in collection activities that didn't have anything to do with my clients, with the appellants, and other matters, other pre-traverse matters. We contend that that was error under the governing rule here, which is Rule 103. We begin, I think, with the American rule. Under the American rule, as your honors know, fees are not shifted in the absence of either a statute or a rule or a contract. And so the question here is whether the rule, Rule 103, shifts fees incurred in other than the traverse proceedings or permits the trial court to shift those fees. We also know from the case law cited in our briefs that exceptions to the American rule are construed narrowly. This court and the Supreme Court have consistently done that, and that's been the rule throughout the United States. The U.S. Supreme Court has done so as well. The standard applicable, as I indicated, is found in Rule 103 and specifically Section 8B5. And what that section says is the standard the trial court was to apply is that the court shall make such orders as to reasonable attorneys' fees of the parties to such hearing as are just. The trial court interpreted that to mean that any fees of any party to the hearing were fair game and could be shifted, and it looked to attorney's fees and costs that were incurred long before the traverse hearing and fees that had nothing to do with my clients, with the appellants who intervened. The language I think that's relevant in that rule to the analysis here is fees to such hearing. So what the rule says is fees of the parties, so it's got to be a fee of the parties to the hearing, and it's got to be a fee to such hearing. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense. Why would the rule say that fees of the parties, regardless of whether they are incurred in connection with the traverse hearing, where this language is found, where the fee shifting provision is located, can be shifted? What would limit that? And it seems to me that nothing would limit it. The only thing that really makes any sense, the only way to analyze this issue in a sensible way, is to confine the trial court's discretion, which it clearly has, but to define that discretion to the attorney's fees and costs that are incurred of the parties to such hearing. Here, the trial court admittedly, I don't think there's any dispute about the fact that the attorney's fees and costs that were awarded included fees and costs that had nothing to do with the traverse hearing that my clients were brought into this matter in connection with. So in addition to that, there are two other factors I think that are important. One is that the two other factors which reinforce the language of the rule. The first is the location of the fee-shifting provision in the rule. It's in subsection 8 of the rule. Subsection 8 deals exclusively with traverse issues. So I think the location of the fee-shifting provision and the traverse provision of the rule must mean something. It was put in there for a reason. If the court was meant to be granted discretion to shift fees for things other than the parties to such hearing, the fees incurred in connection with such hearing, then the fee-shifting provision, I suggest to you, would have been located somewhere else in the rule, in a general provision of the garnishment rule. It isn't. It's in the specific provision of the rule dealing with traverses. The second is going back to application of the American rule. If the fee-shifting provision is interpreted as broadly as the trial court did to include any fees of anyone who's a party to the hearing, then the American rule really doesn't mean very much because we're not construing the exception narrowly, as the Supreme Court and this court has directed that should be done. Instead, we're construing the exception broadly to the point where the exception frankly swallows the rule. So for those reasons, we contend that the trial court erred in construing the provisions of the rule so broadly that they swept in attorney's fees and costs of the plaintiff that were far broader than those that included just the traverse fees and costs. The second issue is whether the trial court erred in shifting the burden of proof. This issue concerns primarily the concept of block billing. Block billing, as the court undoubtedly is aware, is, and I'll quote briefly from Payon v. Nash Finch, a decision out of this court in 2012. Block billing is a form of timekeeping that involves stating the total daily time spent on a case rather than separating out the time into individual entries describing specific activities. Plaintiff's motion for fees in this case, which was extensive, included scores and scores of entries, of time entries, that were clearly block billings. And we've included one example in our brief and cited many, many others. The example we gave goes on for, I think, 15 lines, single-space lines, and describes the total time spent as 15.7 hours, but doesn't identify how much time was spent on a particular task. So we were unable, because of that, to determine how much time was spent by that lawyer on each particular task. An example would be, just to take the first thing that was stated in the example we gave in the brief, the first time entry is review email received overnight from J.S. Bender concerning edits to draft or traverse, but no time assigned to that. So we don't know if they spent 2 minutes, 10 minutes, 2 hours, 3 hours of the 15.7 daily hours on that. The trial court required in the procedural order that was entered that the appellants identify each particular activity, was the language the court used, that we contended the time span or the amount was reasonable, and that we identify how much time would have been reasonable for that particular activity. We noted to the trial court, we specifically pointed out to the trial court in response to that order, we can't do that because the entries are blocked billings. So what you want us to do, Judge, is to say whether the review of email time entry was excessive, but we can't do it because we don't know how much time was spent. So please have them tell us how much time they spent doing that. Then we'd be able to identify whether it was reasonable and the amount of time that we thought was unreasonable. We did go through in response to the trial court's order and say, here are all the block billings that are problems because we are unable to break down the time and tell you how much we think would have been reasonable and what was unreasonable about the time that was spent. The trial court denied that, said, no, you are to respond and tell us with these charts exactly what the time entries are that are inappropriate. And obviously, we were unable to do that. The trial court then did rely on the lack of specificity that I just cited that we were unable to provide in the fee order. The trial court specifically cited and referred to that. And we cite the page of the order in the brief, but the trial court said that the interveners do not direct the court to those charges they are challenging. But that was incorrect. We did exactly, we did direct the court exactly to those time entries that were block billings and where we were unable to break down how much time we thought was reasonable and unreasonable. So by requiring us to do something that we were simply unable to do, the effect of the trial court's order was to shift the burden of proof from the plaintiff, who clearly had the burden of proof on the issue of the reasonableness of attorney's fees, to the interveners to disprove the reasonableness of the attorney's fees. And that was error, and it was an error that was prejudicial to the interveners because the trial court relied on that lack of specificity, the lack of proving unreasonableness in its order. Finally, let me just briefly comment on the third issue, which is the joint and several award. The trial court in this case entered the attorney's fee award and cost award jointly and severally against all the parties. That issue never rose before that order. The plaintiff never requested a joint and several award, and the trial court never indicated that it would enter a joint and several award. So once the award was entered, we filed a motion to reconsider and said, Judge, it's inappropriate for you, particularly without any findings of fact or conclusions. No, that's not true. Without any findings of fact whatsoever, to find that, to conclude that the award should be joint and several. Here, the circumstances of each of the interveners was very different. Only one of the interveners, CCG LLC, was determined to be liable for the judgment. The others were the recipients of avoidable transfers under the fraudulent transfer statute, which the court avoided, but the amounts of those varied quite significantly, and they were not liable for the judgment. So the trial court, at a minimum, should have made some findings about why everyone was liable jointly and severally. That the trial court failed to do, and we contend that that was error. For those reasons, we ask that the judgment of the trial court with respect to costs and attorney's fees be reversed and the matter remanded to the trial court for new findings and conclusions based on the evidentiary record that was presented. If the court has no questions, I'll reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Christina Gomez, bar registration number 36026. I represent Lowe Partners Corporation as agent for the plaintiffs who are the judgment creditors in this proceeding. This is our third time before the court on this proceeding to enforce a $1.7 million judgment entered in New York against Jack Greinberg. It was only recently, after 5.5 years of intense litigation in the Colorado courts, that the plaintiffs finally were able to collect that judgment. Interveners admit that the plaintiffs are entitled to recover attorney fees for their collection efforts leading up to the traverse hearing. Their challenges to the fee award, though, ignore both the trial court's discretion in awarding fees and their own complicity in Greinberg's attempts to avoid payment of the judgment at all costs. The interveners here, there are four of them. One is Greinberg's wife. The other three are family businesses that Greinberg controls. One of those, CCG, is his alter ego, and the others, including Celeste Greinberg, his wife, and the two businesses, each individually received fraudulent transfers exceeding $1 million to avoid payment of the judgment. As with the prior appeals, this appeal here, all three of the arguments raised are meritless. I'll address each of them very, very briefly and then go into more detail on each one. First, the trial court acted within its discretion in awarding attorney fees under Rule 103, Section 8B5. The rule itself does not limit the scope of attorney fees available. It simply provides a trigger for recovering fees and then leaves it to the court's discretion to determine in each individual circumstance whether to award fees, and if so, the scope of fees that is just under the circumstances.
What's the limiting principle? I mean, this is the American rule we're dealing with, and we have to narrowly construe any exception to the American rule. Seems like your interpretation and the court's interpretation is the most expansive reading possible of this provision. I mean, after all, what would have prevented the district court from awarding the fees incurred to obtain the underlying judgment under its rationale?
I would say that would be an abuse of discretion.
Why?
I would have.
But its rationale, that's where its rationale goes. I mean, if the court's rationale was a but-for test, you had to incur these fees to do this in the traverse proceeding. Well, you had to incur the fees to get the judgment, to get the money, to get through the traverse proceeding too. So there's just no limit here.
That is true, but all of the fees incurred in this proceeding were, there was a judgment prior to it. So at least here, all we have are the fees of collecting a judgment that already had been, you know, in put in place. And I would say just the fact that it's limited by abuse of discretion does not mean that it's unbounded. There still are limiting principles to what is an abuse of discretion. There had to be some reasoning behind it. It had to be supported by facts. And in this case, I will concede it's not ordinarily how things would go, but this is that extraordinary case. And the findings here were extraordinary, that Greinberg had worked collectively with the interveners, in particular GPC, which no longer is participating in this action, and CCG, but had worked with them to Herculean efforts to avoid payment of the judgment. There were very, very detailed findings that supported the award here, that in this case, it all led up to this traverse hearing. I will say, if the court is concerned that there is no line drawn here, one place you could draw the line is there was the domestication and the appeal of the domestication. By my calculation, that was only about $88,000 of the fees, if you just pull those out of it. Everything else was leading straight up to that traverse hearing, doing discovery, taking depositions, tracing the assets, figuring out where they came from, and then preparing everything to do to serve the writs of garnishment. And at that point, it very quickly required the traverses to be filed, because under the rules, you file the writs of, you serve the writs of garnishment, the garnishees have 10 days to answer, and within 20 days of those answers, you have to have your traverse, which is basically your pleading that sets out, I mean, in this case, we had to set out all of the bases for alter ego and fraudulent transfers. So, I mean, that's what I would say. If the court is concerned, well, the domestication, you know, if you're saying that leads up to the judgment, then maybe everything does. I would first of all say there is a difference in domesticating and defending that and the underlying litigation, which we're not seeking here. There can be a line drawn there, but there also can be a line drawn, as I said, after the domestication is done and you proceed toward, we're trying to figure out how to get this money from the interveners and kind of build that alter ego fraudulent transfer case.
Counsel, do you concede that had the banks responded to the writs saying, here we have money and here it is, and there had been no intervention, no contest, that you would not have been entitled to recover any of these fees?
I actually disagree, because in that circumstance, we would not have just collected that money. There's no doubt in this case that it would have been that simple. What would have happened in that case is the interveners would have still intervened and claimed
no,
that
no,
money
no.
was there.
My hypothetical is no contest to the writs of garnishment. Okay, so you do all this work that you're talking about to file your writs of garnishment. You file them or you serve them, and they're complied with in full. There's no contest. Under
that
the rule,
true.
There's no means of recovering the fees, right?
Not exactly, and there's two reasons why. Well, first of all, your hypothetical is that there is no dispute about it, and you know there are no further proceedings. In reality, the interveners would have filed their own traverses under the rule, because interveners and attachment can file traverses. But putting even that aside, if there had been no traverses here, and well, I guess you're assuming that we never had to prove fraudulent transfer and all of those things. But
no, I don't care what you had to prove. No traverse, so no trigger, as you
okay.
put it.
Okay, that is correct then.
All right.
I mean,
so what's the rationale? I mean, frankly, it doesn't seem to make any sense to me that this Colorado Supreme Court would then say, because there's a traverse, that opens it all up. All these suddenly become recoverable when they weren't recoverable before.
Well, if we had to prove those theories in any other litigation, there is, I mean, when we filed separate actions because the interveners were challenging the use of the Rule 103 proceeding, we did seek attorney fees under CUFTA. And, you know, you could have gotten fees that way. And I mean, at the same point, you could say, well, you shouldn't get fees if you won without having to prove it, even though you had started building your case, but you should get, in some respects, it's not fair to say that because, like in a CUFTA proceeding, you still would have had to do all the discovery to lead up to proving the claim. I mean, I don't know. I guess what I'm saying here is it's inconceivable in this case that we would not have had to make our proof under fraudulent transfer and alter ego theories. It's inconceivable that we would have ended up in that situation. I concede, had we would not have recovered our fees. But we all along knew Greinberg and his companies have contested every single step of everything we've done all along the way. And the interveners would have, as interveners, an attachment filed a traverse. We would have ended up in the same place, just who's filing the traverses and who's defending that.
But we can't interpret the rule different on a case-by-case basis, depending on what the facts are. I'm looking for the principle here.
That is true, and the principle is the bounds of what is discretionary. And this is that exceptional case where the findings of the trial court that justified what the trial court decided to do were these extraordinary findings. These parties have colluded with one another to make it as difficult as possible to obtain this judgment. And, you know, the rule itself, it does not have any limiting language. So if you're reading some limiting language in it, I mean, in a sense, you're adding something to the rule and possibly misinterpreting it.
But doesn't the rule itself limit itself by talking about at any hearing upon a traverse, and then it ends with, you know, expenses of the parties to such a hearing? It seems to be like this self-contained proceeding, and your reading seems to be trying to expand that language. Why shouldn't we conclude that it is more limited?
Well, there is a limitation that, first of all, there's a limitation that you have to hold a hearing. I mean, you have to be in the traverse proceedings. Second, there is a limitation that it has to be among the parties to the hearing. And as I indicated earlier, if there are concerns over the issue of the domestication itself, at least everything that leads up to that hearing, which was a hearing to prove the alter ego and fraudulent transfer theories, all of that should be awardable just the same as if we were in a separate action under CUFTA where we, you know, filed a complaint and you know, did the discovery and everything leading up to an ultimate judgment on the merits. So, you know, that would provide those bounds. I will say also, though, in this court's decision in the Law Offices of Andrew Kwiat case, it was, you know, not exactly the same here, but certainly it's clear from the court's decision that fees were awarded under statute and under the rule, but even just under the rule, they were awarded not only for the traverse, but also for defending motions to intervene, the other motions that were filed, which included, I think, a motion to intervene, a motion to amend the judgment. And, you know, the court found that was not an abuse of discretion in that case.
Well, the issue wasn't squarely before the court in that case.
That is correct.
All right. Let's talk about this statute, 1316.123, which I'm sure you're familiar with. That deals with all of these things that you're seeking fees for. If the garnishee incurs, it's fees in excess of the cost of preparing and filing the answer, et cetera, et cetera, and says that they can maybe recoverable if the bringing or maintaining or defense of the action was frivolous, groundless, et cetera. Why doesn't that just cover the situation that you're talking about where some party makes it so difficult, you know, doing everything within its power to hide assets, blah, blah, blah? I mean, why doesn't that cover it?
That statute is limited, as I understand it, to garnishees.
It's kind of an odd statute, actually. It talks about garnishees, but then it talks about finds that the bringing of the action or the defense of the action involving the garnishee was frivolous. And obviously, that covers both sides. So it's kind of a strange statute.
Right.
Okay. I guess my point is, you know, the General Assembly addressed the issue of you know, when fees get incurred and it's kind of a difficult case, and they placed a limit on it, why wouldn't the Supreme Court doing the same thing by putting one little provision in Section 8 of 103? I mean, if it wanted a general attorney fees provision, it certainly could have adopted one, but it just didn't.
Well, what it actually, if you look at the garnishment statute, there's not anything that covers any of these issues in the statute itself. It just lays out some other issues and then leaves the Supreme Court to adopt rules that will be applied.
The court did adopt another attorney fees provision in 103. That's in Section 7.
Right.
All right. So we've got two specific provisions in two specific sections. Doesn't that indicate an intent to limit the fees to the circumstances where fees are incurred in those particular kind of proceedings? Section 8 deals with traverses, so fees are limited to traverses.
Not necessarily, because the way the rule is laid out, there are basically three ways that you could end up in a hearing situation. It's this here with the traverses, where the garnishee fails to answer, and then you've got to try to prove up the claim. And then it's where the judgment debtor claims some exemption. And as I read that, it's basically saying, in that circumstance where you're dealing with issues of possible exemptions, we don't want to require the parties to have to pay fees in that scenario here. So that's a way that you can say it has some meaning here. But, you know, as we've said, once that trigger is there, you're looking at, it's the party's truth to the traverse. You have had a traverse. And, you know, as I've said here, at least my secondary argument is that if you want to take the domestication out of it, that's one thing. But everything else really directly ties to the preparation of the traverses and leading up to that traverse hearing. And that's 90% of the attorney fee award here.
Let me ask you something about the record so I'm clear on it. Weren't some of the fees awarded for the Wyoming case?
No, there was. What happened is there was, it looked like there were a few things that inadvertently had been left in that related to the Wyoming case, and then we took them out later out of what we actually were requesting. We had conceded there were little pieces that had been left in, and that actually, like I said, was taken out of ultimately what we had requested. It was very minor amounts, and I think it was our initial reply brief. There were many briefs along the way, but I think it was our initial reply brief that may have addressed that issue.
Okay.
What I'd like to say finally, just very briefly on the other two points, is, I mean, as to the burdens of proof, the trial court basically said interveners needed to lodge their objections, but at the end of the day, it's going to be up to plaintiffs to prove the amount and the reasonableness of their fees. And it found that to the large extent, plaintiffs had done that, and to the extent that they hadn't, the court reduced the fees accordingly. And finally, on the last issue, in terms of joint and several liability, there were many findings in the initial Rule 103 order that supported it, including a finding that each of the fraudulent transfers were subject to the judgment and to attorney fees and costs that may be awarded later under Section 8B5. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel.
Plaintiff's argument is about complicity, counsel used that word, of the interveners, and I think that's just an incorrect interpretation of what the trial court found. The trial court determined that Mr. Greinberg had engaged in what the trial court referred to as Herculean efforts not to pay the judgment. But there was not a finding that the interveners engaged in any Herculean or otherwise efforts not to pay the judgment. There was no conspiracy claim. There was no conspiracy finding as to the interveners. The only finding by the trial courts, the only findings that are relevant here is that one of the parties, CG LLC, was an alter ego, and the others had received fraudulent transfers.
But the other entities were, with the exception of Mr. Greinberg's wife, were controlled by Mr. Greinberg.
No, the trial court didn't find that, Your Honor. What the trial court found is that the other entities were the recipients of fraudulent transfers.
Well, it didn't find that they were alter egos, but I think, isn't it a matter of the record that those are entities that are controlled
no,
by Mr. Greinberg?
No, I don't believe so. He was the president, but the argument was made by counsel, by plaintiff below, that those entities were controlled by Mr. Greinberg, and I don't believe, I hope I'm not mistaken, but I do not believe the trial court made any findings to the effect that those entities were all controlled by Mr. Greinberg.
I'm a little confused. He's the president.
If that finding was made, I apologize.
He's the president, but he doesn't control.
Yeah, well, he controls them as the officer, but he was not the owner of the entities. And they actually were owned by his adult children, 50-year-old children, and his wife. So there weren't specific findings on that issue. But the notion that someone is bad, basically, is what you're hearing, and therefore the rules should be interpreted in such a way that will penalize them in the greatest way possible with an award of attorney's fees, I think is just incorrect. The court should apply the standard in the rule, a standard which is applicable to all parties at all times, and the standard shouldn't vary depending on the nature of the parties. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. For your arguments, the case will stand submitted, and we'll issue an opinion in due course. I think that completes our document.